You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is the Harvest Hour edition, an extra half hour of the Closing Market Report from now until Friday, October the 10th. While farmers are in the combine cabs, they're not quite there yet, but once they get there, we'll be going an extra half hour and taking phone calls on different agricultural topics. Today, our guest in studio with us is from the University of Illinois. He's in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences, College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences as well. Name is Mark David. He's here to talk about the hypoxia zone in the Gulf of Mexico, sources of possible reductions in nutrients from the Mississippi River Basin. Good afternoon to you, Mark. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Todd. I'm glad to be here.
We'll take phone calls for him in just a few moments, but I'll give those numbers out in just a bit. Mark, why don't you first tell me a little bit about yourself and then about the Science Advisory Board that you participated in from US EPA.
Well, I'm a professor at the university, and I study how nutrients move around, how we add them to agricultural fields, how they move from those fields into streams and rivers, and then what happens to them after that. And so I'm very interested in nitrogen and phosphorus and sort of how we've changed or what's going on with the current cycles of those. Now, the Science Advisory Board was the latest group that was part of US EPA, and it was a team of scientists that were put together to review the state of science, what we know about hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico, both on the marine side, but also on what's the source of the nutrients, and then what could we do about it.
Tell me about your work and how you gather that information.
A lot of the data that we get comes from two sources. A lot comes from agricultural statistics. The Agricultural Statistics Service provides a lot of the nutrient data, the harvest yields, and things that we can use to do the calculations. And then we use a lot of monitoring data from the U.S. Geological Survey. They monitor the rivers, the flow, and what's in and the nutrients that are in them. And those two things are very important to determine where nutrients are coming from and when.
In just a couple of minutes, we'll come back. We'll talk more with you about the work and what the findings were, and maybe if there were some recommendations to the Science Advisory Board about the hypoxia zone, and maybe you'll tell us a little bit about just what exactly a hypoxia zone in the Gulf of Mexico is. But now we probably better check in with the folks at the Business Report, and Phil Brunson of Wachovia is on the line, should join us to tell us a little bit more about how Wall Street is ending the afternoon. Tough day in Wall Street, Bill.
Well, the Dow and the NASDAQ have recovered from substantial losses for the second time today and turned higher after a report that the Federal Reserve is considering a loan package to American International Group. AIG is down 88 cents to $3.88, and many other financial stocks gained on the news. Another report released the last few minutes says Barclays PLC has reached an agreement to buy Lehman Brothers assets. The news is taking the spotlight away from the Federal Reserve, which announced no change in interest rates following its regular meeting. The Fed said the downside risk to growth remains, but also said it was concerned about the upside risk to inflation. Many traders were looking for a rate cut to boost market sentiment as turmoil continues in the financial sector. And currently, the Dow is up 136 points at 11,054. Volume is at 1.7 billion shares. And the NASDAQ Composite is up 21 points at 200 even. The 10-year Treasury note is down 22 32nds, currently yielding 3.47%. This has been Phil Brunson with Wachovia Securities in the Mid-Afternoon Report.
Thanks much to Phil. He's with Wachovia Securities, joins us here oftentimes on the Afternoon Magazine. Of course, this edition we'll call the Closing Market Report, Harvest Hour, in studio with us this afternoon, Mark David with NRAS and the College of ACES, right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. We're going to talk about the hypoxia zone and the nutrient load that may be affecting it that's coming down from the Midwest. Mark, thanks much for being with us. Why don't you broach that subject for us just a bit, and I'll remind our listeners that they can call in and join us if they'd like at 800-222-9455 or 333-9455. That's a 217 area code. So the nutrient load, is there one that comes out of the Midwest that feeds the hypoxia zone?
Yeah, let me first just say what the hypoxic zone is and then how the nutrients lead into it. Basically, nutrients or water and nutrients go down the Mississippi River and enter the Gulf of Mexico. And in the spring, that water, that fresh water, actually puts a cap over part of the Gulf of Mexico. The nutrients then cause algal growth, plant growth to occur. the algae then die and they use up the oxygen, and that leads to what we call a hypoxic zone or low oxygen. And organisms that can swim away or survive, those that can't swim away can be killed. And so that's the problem. And so it's the spring flush of fresh water and the nutrients that are in that. What we reaffirmed and what we came up with in the Science Advisory Board is that, again, it's nitrate that is the primary nutrient that causes the problem, but also that phosphorus was important. And in particular, the spring load of those nutrients, particularly the spring load of nitrate, the April, May, June nitrate that goes down the Mississippi River. The other thing we found is, where does that nitrate come from? It really comes from the tile-drained corn and soybean fields of the upper Midwest. So southwest Minnesota through Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, into Ohio. That is really the source of the nitrate. It's also the source of a large part of the phosphorus as well. And our recommendation, and what the conclusion we came to, reduce the hypoxic zone to a reasonable size would take 45% reductions of both nitrate and phosphorus going down the river.
Well, how do you achieve that kind of reduction in the load? It seems like an awfully large reduction, and I don't know that producers would be
right
willing to.
Now that does not mean a 45% reduction, say, in inputs. It means what ends up going down the river. Again, there's two sources of these nutrients. One is, of course, the agricultural fields. The other is point sources from cities, sewage effluent. We looked at the sewage effluent, particularly for nitrogen. Even if we made that zero, that would only be maybe a 10% reduction. So it really, for nitrate, it comes down to agriculture. We looked at, basically, our conclusion was that it would be very hard to do it. We agree. I mean, there's no simple one step. We don't think farmers are applying too much fertilizer. A lot of people thought that the answer was, well, just add the right amount of fertilizer. Well, our conclusion is, for the most part, we are adding pretty much the right amount of fertilizer. So it's not that simple. We came up with a whole series of things. The bottom line is that corn and soybean production is fairly what we call leaky. I mean, nitrate comes out even under the best of management because it rains in the spring often at the wrong time, and with tile drainage, we lose nitrate. So we came up with then a whole series of things that could be done, but the conclusion then is there's just no one silver bullet that's going to make this go away.
Listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, you can. You can dial in at 800-222-9455, or if you're local, 217-333-9455. Those last four numbers on both stand for WILL. That's 800-222-WILL and 217-333-WILL. If you'd like to join the conversation with Mark David this afternoon, you said there were some things that can be done. What are they?
Well, clearly, in the long term, if we really wanted to reduce nutrients, our conclusion, and this has been seen in other places as well, is that we need what we would call more complex rotations, adding other crops in. Now, right now, the system is not really built for that. I mean, corn and soybeans are the ones that are the most valuable and produce the greatest value per acre. But if we were to go to more rotations that had other crops in them, and one of the ones that may come up that really would help from a nutrient perspective are the biofuel crops. A lot of the perennial grasses, things like miscanthus and switchgrass, really would help to reduce nutrient loss. But given that we're going to stay in corn and soybeans, we came up with several things. One of the problems we've identified is fall and application. You know, putting nitrate or anhydrous ammonia, other forms on in the fall leads to greater losses than putting it on in the spring.
Can you quantify that between southern Illinois and the northern two-thirds of Illinois? Southern Illinois generally does not put anhydrous ammonia on in the fall.
Right, but they have very low nitrate losses, but it's not because of that. It's because there's very little tile drainage. So southern Illinois, even though it's spring applied, that isn't the reason the rivers down there don't have much nitrate. The reason is there's no tile drainage down there.
We have a phone call this afternoon from Urbana on line one with us. Good afternoon to you.
Hello.
Your question for Mark David?
Yeah, I'm calling about the miscanthus. At DeGrimi Day, they said that it absorbed a lot of water, and I was wondering if we're not going to switch to that as a crop anytime soon, but if that, I don't even know if it's legal, but if you could plant that in CRP acres, just so it would absorb the water and prevent the leaching.
Well, in CRP acres, we don't lose any nitrate. I mean, CRP acres are always a sort of a perennial system, some kind of perennial grass or even trees, and so we don't really lose nutrients there.
But typically, CRP is like along creeks where you'd have the or a lot of CRP is along creeks and stuff where you're having drainage.
Right, but I think his point is that no matter what you put there, it's not going to be harvested, so that. Your suggestion is that because it takes up so much more water that you would put it there to keep it drier?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is, if we had lots of acres of miscanthus around, whether it was along river banks or not, there's no doubt that would reduce the amount of water going into the rivers. How much and whether that would be meaningful or not, it's hard to say. It wouldn't do much for flood conditions. It would do more at this time of year at low flow, and it might make rivers lower.
Yeah, and I think as you took a look at the miscanthus and other types of things that would be coming along as biofuels, I assume the assumption would be that those would be on the areas that would be less productive because they're perennials, and they would maybe take the place of CRP acres and become productive for a producer.
That's one, you could use them in that way, but others are thinking that maybe these would be on some of the better lands as well, because again, it gives us an alternate crop, it makes the landscape a little more variable, and because these are very efficient plants, we would add very little fertilizer, and there's no doubt that the nitrate loss would go down dramatically.
What are the other types of things that your recommendations were coming
up? Well, so we talked already about fall in. The other things are basically doing things either on the field, things like cover crops in the winter, doing things with tile drainage management, water management, putting valves in tiles and shutting them at times has been talked about quite a bit. Putting wetlands at the end of tile lines is another approach. That's an off-site kind of approach. Things like tile bioreactors, which have been studied in our ag and biological engineering department. So there's a whole range of things from trying to do some things in the field to doing things off the field with essentially doing something with the tile water. For phosphorus, we have a few other things that could be done. Phosphorus, one of the problems is the fertilizer is not often incorporated after it's put on, and incorporating into the soil helps to reduce the losses of it. And the other thing for phosphorus is that a lot of the phosphorus is lost through surface runoff, water moving over the soil and carried with it with sediment. And so then riparian buffer strips work. Now, when I talked about nitrate, riparian buffer strips would do nothing for nitrate, because if you have a tile, then that takes any buffer strip out of the equation. But for phosphorus, they can work quite well.
Mark will come back and speak with you in just about 2 minutes. As a reminder, you're listening to a Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Mark Report. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can dial in over the next 2 minutes at 1-800-222-9455 or at 217-333-9455. Both of those stand for WILL. We're here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, speaking this afternoon with Mark David with NRAS out of the College of ACES.